create a war, you create a conflict in order to distract attention from what's happening in the U.S. So there is a national component, a U.S. component to this conflict. There's a Venezuelan component, but they dovetail nicely around the issue of the deportations as Trump seeks to distract attention from the Epstein case and from the economy and from other issues that are occurring in the U.S.
Finally, Vice President J.D. Vance dismissed accusations that the first attack on the boat that killed 11 people may have been a war crime if civilians were on board. Vance wrote on X, "I don't give a," it rhymes with hit, "what you think," he said. "I don't give a what you call it," using the expletive. He was responding to Republican Senator Rand Paul criticizing Vance's comments, saying what a despicable and thoughtless sentiment it is to glorify killing someone without a trial. You have 10 seconds, Professor Tinker Salas.
Again, the U.S. puts itself above the law, above international law, and places itself as a judge, jury, and executioner without ever providing any evidence.
Professor McGill Tinker Salas, Emeritus Professor of History at Pomona College in Claremont, California. You can go to our website for our interview with him in Spanish at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Programming on KFAI is sponsored by NDC and MITA, administrators of DEED's Minnesota Promise Act. The Minnesota Promise Act provides grants and loans for disadvantaged businesses in specific neighborhoods of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Application details can be found at mnpromiseact.org.
Programming is supported by Grand Casino Mille Lacs. The Vietnamese show Mid-Autumn Showcase is headed to Grand Casino Mille Lacs. Mid-Autumn Showcase ticket holders will experience a night of Vietnamese entertainers bringing their talents to the stage on Saturday, October 4th. Tickets are on sale now at GrandCasinoMN.com.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarland, host of The Conversation with Al McFarland. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Well, today is the Healing Circle, and normally I'm joined by my co-hosts and colleagues, my leaders in the area of mental health awareness, Dr. Babata Garrett Akinsanya, she might or might not be on today, and Dr. Oliver Williams, another colleague, are usually here. But we proceed. Our topic today is an important one, one that we'll be visiting, I'm sure, many times in the future, because it's that important. The theme for today's program is a discussion on gambling. The theme is gambling is more than a man's game. And this conversation wants to bring forward lived experiences of two of my guests today, Christina Cook and Tara Carbert. They're going to share their personal stories of how problem gambling affected their lives and families. And we also have, and leading off the conversation, actually guiding us in it, is Susan Sheridan Tucker. She's executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling. And she is going to give us some practical advice on guidance on prevention, on support, on treatment, resources, and beyond. And over the course of this hour, we want to cover what the warning signs are that family and friends should watch for. We should look at why the playoff season and the championship games can fuel risky betting. Look at how to start conversations, hard conversations with loved ones without shame. And what do we know, what we can learn, what can we learn about safer gambling, what tips are there, and when should we seek help? Finally, we want to just examine the question of how and why gambling harm impacts everyone, not just men, not just the gamblers. So with that, again, thank you all and welcome to the Friday edition of The Conversation with Al McFarland. Let me invite you to share like the program. Let somebody know that this conversation is going on right now. And we're streaming to Facebook, to LinkedIn, and to YouTube. We want you to go to our YouTube channel, Insight News MN, YouTube Insight News MN, and subscribe, like, and share. And we appreciate that. So let's jump right into it. Susan, Sheridan, Tucker, Tara, Christina, thank you all for being here. Susan, I'll go to you first. Just set the stage for a conversation. What is the work of the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling? What is problem gambling?
Thank you, Al. So the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling is the state affiliate to the National Council on Problem Gambling. And as the national and also state affiliates, our mission is to help those that are negatively impacted by gambling. And nationally, 2 to 4% of the population are impacted by problem gambling. Within that, there are people who have severe addictions. It's a spectrum. So when we look at the criteria for somebody who is considered to have problem gambling or gambling addiction, the DSM-5, which is the diagnostic manual that dictates the diagnosis, names 9 criteria for problem gambling. And if a person even shows one sign, they land on that spectrum. And even with one sign, you want to make sure that you're having conversations. But some of those signs are that people are becoming much more obsessed with their gambling. They're spending more time, they're spending more money than they can afford. So often they'll be chasing their losses as they continue to play. We find that as gamblers become more entrenched in their play, they will often lie about what they're doing to hide from family members that they're as engaged in the activity as they are. And often, and Christina and Tara will certainly talk about this, that spending time, that there are many attempts in which you tell yourself it's time to stop and you find that you can't stop. And so that has all sorts of implications to relationships, to showing up for work or school. So it impacts not just the gambler, it impacts family, it impacts the community. Money that could be invested in the community or within the family is lost. So financial, situations, crisis, bankruptcy, all of that becomes part of this addiction.
Let me invite another voice in, my co-host and partner in our Friday Healing Circle, and that's Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. She is the leader at the African American Child Wellness Institute. Just so you guys know, the Institute is a culturally specific trauma-informed agency that she created in 2009. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and licensed independent clinical social worker. She's also Minnesota's only certified diplomate fellow in African-centered Black psychology. It's a status that's conferred by the National Association of Black Psychologists. And she's the driving force in this Friday program, The Healing Circle. Dr. B, welcome. Good afternoon. Good to see you again.
Thank you. It's good to see you too, Al. And to see my sisters here talking about something that is so important to our community and our need for speaking the truth out loud and acknowledging it so that we can hopefully change.
You know, I didn't open the program with the protocol that I depend on you to open up. And so if my guests don't mind, I'm going to share with you a joyful method of centering this conversation that comes out of our experience as African people. Dr. B, would you?
I'm happy to do it. I want to invite everybody in the audience as well as around this virtual table to imagine that we're sitting in circle. And circle is a very spiritual act. It's one of seeing connection and one of valuing Ubuntu, which means that we are part of community. I am because you are, because we are, and we are because I am. So as we sit in this African circle, we sit here knowing in a circle there is no beginning or end. There is no top or bottom. Everyone in the circle has equal access to the center where there is voice and a space of sheer power. So what we do now as we sit here in this circle, I invite you to look to your right and see that you are safe. Look to your left and notice your safety. Look behind you and realize that you are safe. And as you sit in this space, I ask you to breathe deeply, acknowledging your sense of safety and noticing, just noticing how your chair holds you up, how you're in this space, feeling your presence presently. In this circle, we also honor our elders, because in honoring our elders, we recognize the shoulders that we stand on. None of us got here on our own. Someone hoped our way, prayed our way, worked and sacrificed our way into existence. So we sit here now, the embodiment of generations of hopes and dreams. And as we sit in the circle, we honor our ancestors, because those were the shoulders that our elders stood on. And as we honor our ancestors, we also recognize that they are closest to our Creator. So we honor them. And in this space of honoring, we ask that we heal together by acknowledging our common hopes and dreams and barriers and threats. And in this circle, we recognize that as we call on our elders, and we call on the spirits of our ancestors, they give us the courage to do difficult things and do it graciously, holistically, in a space of wellness. In our circle, because we are virtual, we use a virtual talking stick. So the stick moves from one person to the next. And if the spirit moves and you need the stick, all you need to do is ask for it, and the stick will be given to you. So we welcome you today to our healing circle, to our community, and to our ritual of healing and claiming our right to be well. We welcome you today. And as we say to our ancestors and to each other, we say Ashe, which means thank you and welcome. Ashe, Ashe. You may say it, Ashe.
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 Ashe. Ashe.
So, Baba Al, I give you the talking stick. And thank you for giving me voice. And you're muted.
Got it, yeah. thank you, Dr. B. It's a wonderful way to begin any meeting. It's setting up. You know, why it matters to me personally, I'll give you guys a story, is that I went to Ghana, I think maybe in 1994 or 99, somewhere in the area. I had a chance to meet with a number of elders in different events, different political and government and traditional leaders. And every time they met, they started off with a certain protocol. And I just noticed it. I wasn't told about it, but I figured it out after the third or fourth meeting. And the meeting would be, you know, 8, 9, 10 people around a conference table somewhere. And the convener would, you know, sort of set the mood and the intention of the meeting, but begin by acknowledging the elders, you know, the ancestors, the elders, the public officials, and ordinary sisters and brothers in the room and in community who might not be present, but whose voices and spirit would be reflected in the conversation. And each of those statements of opening would both acknowledge the shared responsibility of everybody in the room, that sharing and that connection to community would also allow the speaker to attest his or her intention within the context of community intention. So I love that. It was really a cool thing to do. So let me keep going with, first of all, you know, we heard Susan Sheridan Tucker talk about, you know, problem gambling broadly. Let me tell you a little bit more about her, and then I'll bring other guests in. She's the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling, and she's board president of the National Council on Problem Gambling. And she's been with this organization since 2018. Over the past 30 years, her career has focused on nonprofit management, building organizations, and advocating for those with diminished voice or power. She's got a master's degree in urban planning, laid the foundation for her community building and strategic planning work. And through her leadership, the organization is increasing Minnesotans' awareness to gambling addiction, emphasizing the connections between substance use disorder and mental health. And her overall focus is to build a stronger infrastructure about problem or around or of problem gambling services in Minnesota. So we'll keep hearing more about that. And thank you for the work you do and for being here. Then we've got two guests, Christina Cook. And, you know, she was personally impacted by problem gambling. And she can tell you her story. The same with our friend Tara. So let me do this. Christina, welcome. Let me just turn the talking stick to you. And as the spirit leads you, share your story.
Thank you. Yeah, for me, I struggled with problem gambling for about 15 years, 4.5 years in recovery from gambling. And that's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of work to undo the harm that I experienced through my gambling. I started around the age of 28, and I'll make this as quick as I can, but it's, you know, hard to shorten up 15 years in a small little segment, but
take your time.
I started when I was 28. I found myself divorced and kind of feeling a little bit disconnected from my community around me. My friends were getting married or having babies, and I was single and kind of struggling for connection. And so I started going to the casino occasionally to kind of get out of the house. It was, to me, a better thing to do than hit the bars. And it felt safe. It was well lit, hindsight. But I started going pretty, I wouldn't say super regularly, but on occasional Friday night. And for the first few years, it was exactly what it was intended to be, entertaining. To get you out of the house for a little bit. But as my life just continued to move directions, there was just a lot happening. And instead of seeking proper care, proper mental health care through therapy or other means, I just kept leaning into the gambling. So as my life got a little bit more chaotic and things started happening, I was experiencing abuse in relationships and some just continuous life stuff happening, I just kept leaning into my gambling as a way to kind of cope and to help me get through some of these really, really challenging parts of my life. It was so... Not sure what happened there.
Yeah.
I didn't touch anything.
You're back.
Back. I didn't touch anything. But yeah, so around 2018, you know, my gambling at this point had become pretty detrimental to my finances, my relationships, just my life in general. I was spending my paychecks in a matter of 30 minutes at the casino. And then I was struggling financially until I got paid again. It was just this vicious cycle. And I really started to feel the impacts of the gambling harm that I was creating. It was impacting just everything around me. At that time, I was also diagnosed with cancer. And it was a really devastating time in my life. And again, instead of seeking help through mental health ways or all these other things, I just kept, again, leaning into my gambling as a way to cope and deal with the emotional struggles I was going through. Fast forward, this became really, really detrimental to my life. I was literally just working, gambling, struggling, repeat. So let's just kind of fast forward to 2020, years of just struggle with the gambling. Emotionally, I am broke. Financially, I'm broke. Physically, I'm broke. Like, I'm really, really just feeling the impacts of what I'm doing every day. And then the whole world shut down, and I'm sure I have to be careful with what I say here, but so the casinos were shut down for 4 weeks, and that was the best I'd felt in a really, really long time. I had no access to gambling, and it just gave me a sense of peace. And I wanted that to last. But once everything opened back up, I was back at it 2 weeks later and back in the same cycles. At the end of 2020, I had lost everything financially. It was right before the holidays. I was feeling really, really depressed, having really hard thoughts and just not wanting to be here anymore because of the impacts that gambling and everything else had played on my life. And it was at that moment that I knew something needed to change. And I happened to be watching a show late at night after a gambling binge, and this woman talked about her struggles with food. And I really connected with the emotions. She talked about how she felt before she ate. She talked about how she felt eating, you know, the euphoria, the it feels so good to eat this food. And then she talked about the self-loathing and why she's hurting herself and what this food is doing to her body. And it was an excessive amount of food. It wasn't just a normal meal. And she talked about kind of the addiction that she had with food. And that was really the first time I honestly connected with what I was going through as far as the anticipation to gamble, how I felt gambling, like nothing could touch me while I was gambling. And then the self-loathing and the drive home and how hard I was on myself. And I just realized that I'm struggling with an addiction. And in those 15 years prior, I never once thought that what I was going through was an addiction. I thought I was just bad with money. I thought I was just not a good person. I thought all these things of why I can't do this normally, but never once did I say, I might have an addiction to gambling. Because in the mainstream of things, there's not a lot of conversations happening. It certainly wasn't at that time, not in the way that it is now around sports betting and things like that. So I certainly didn't have a connection with what I was going through. And so I just kind of made a vow to myself that I would not gamble. I would just not gamble. I knew nothing about recovery. I had no idea how challenging that would be, anything like that. So I made it about 60 days until I was triggered by an argument with my then husband. I spent a week-long binge gambling everything I had, everything I'd saved in those 60 days. And that was the lowest I'd ever felt. Like, I really, truly didn't want to be here anymore. I mean, it took me to that really point where I was thinking about how I was going to do that. And I think it was in that moment, you know, I just had a realization that I didn't want to end my life. I actually wanted to live my life. And I hadn't been living in years. I'd been just so trapped in this addiction and in the chaos of it that I knew something had to change and I needed to figure this out. And so I went to my mom the next day. I just told her everything. And she knew somebody had gone to GA. And she said, we're going to figure this out. I called the hotline. I was in a GA meeting a week later, therapy a week after that. And that started the first track of my journey to recovery and getting better. So thank you.
Al, you're muted again. Bye-bye, Al.
What a story. Thank you. Tara, let me pass the talking stick to you and share your story through it.
Yeah, I think you'll probably hear some similarities between Christina's story and mine. I actually was exposed to gambling at an extremely young age. My grandfather liked to take me with him to the VFW where he would play poker with his war buddies. So I learned poker strategy probably before I could read a fifth grade level book. He also, you know, on Sundays was shouting about his football numbers with me. And it wasn't until many years later that I really realized, like, that likely had an effect on the normalization of gambling or making gambling fun. He taught me how to play blackjacks, how people counted cards. And I live in Minnesota, We also went to the grand opening of the horse racing track that is here in Shakopee, Minnesota, and subsequently a casino with table games and slot machines opened later. And I heard my grandparents, who remained married, talk about that and going there and how fun it was. I'm going to fast forward. I could not legally gamble at that time in my life, but I was witnessing gambling. I gambled for the first time at a casino when I was 18. And I would say from my first interaction with gambling, I definitely enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. I found it to be amusing and entertaining, and I liked it. I also didn't have a lot of money. I was 18. I was working, a minimum wage job at that time. And so it was just something, like Christina said, that I would go do for fun, and I would often do it with friends. But almost every time I would go play, I would spend more than I planned, and I would be there longer than I planned. My gambling behavior in my 20s started to escalate for a period of time when my mom passed away. So my mom died of cancer when I was 25. And I had a friend who liked to do poker tournaments. She also liked to play blackjack and slots. And so both of us were single mothers. Both of us were working full time. And that became like the thing I did with my friend on the weekends when I wasn't parenting. And she was doing the same on the weekends when she wasn't parenting. And every time we went, it was out of control and it was an all night thing. And in my 20s, my gambling behavior was interrupted by a hard talk with a friend who said, "What are you doing? You're like, this isn't what your mother would want. This is not, you're supposed to make it. You're going to be the one who graduates college." And I interrupted my gambling behavior from that one, "What are you doing?" conversation with somebody who I knew had my best interests in mind and cared about me a lot. Fast forward about 10 years later, my grandmother, my mother's mom passed away, and she was somebody who I spent time with 2 times a year. She would come and stay with me for a month. And one of the things we would do was go together and socially gamble. And after her passing, I started to go to the casino by myself, and I would play some of the slot machines that she enjoyed and almost feel this connection to her while I was there, and to my grandfather while I was playing blackjack. I was never taught how to deal with my grief. That is why I'm really grateful for places like the one that you guys are holding, where we can have these conversations that are difficult, that bring up hard emotions, but are an example of why healing is so necessary. I grew up in an alcoholic household where the answer to everyday problems, frustrations, fears, and anxiety was have a drink, go to bed, it'll be better tomorrow. And so I was hyper aware that alcohol was a risk for me, but completely oblivious to the fact that gambling was an addictive, was something that you could be addicted to. I earned a fair amount of money, and I wasn't really on my radar that I needed to watch my use, as we might say. I continued to take on additional forms of gambling, which Susan can probably echo is a sign of one of those things on the DSM-5. I was in every fantasy football league at work. I always bought into the lotto pool, and my gambling continued to escalate following my grandmother's death, and I started to go more. A year later, these are things are hard to revisit, so I'm just going to let the tears come if they do. A year later, my sister and I found our father dead, the father who raised me. My biological father actually passed away, died by suicide when I was 3 years old. And after my dad died, it all just kept going and it kept getting worse. My son was older, more independent, leaving me with more free time. I was earning a good living, leaving me with more money. So I had the magic combo that we talk about in the rooms of recovery, time, access, and money. And it just kept escalating and escalating. I started withdrawing from friends. I started making plans centered around when I would be able to place the next bet, and earned myself a reputation of being a gambler while also having this double life of being a highly committed mother and somebody who was high performing at work. So I guess if we were to label that, you know, as a high functioning gambler on the outside, no one knew. No one had any idea how consumed I was with gambling. Happy to say that in July of 2016, I placed my last bet on anything but myself. And I had a similar to Christina, a day at the casino where I had lost everything. I was looking at the life around me and thinking about everything that I wished I had done, feeling like a victim of my own reality, and had a moment where I thought, I'm worth more dead than alive. My personal experience living without my father because he died by suicide, frankly speaking, that single thought terrified me. The thought that I would, through life insurance or something, my family would be better off without me, it scared me. And I called my brother the following morning and, like Christina, was met with love and understanding. And how are we going to get through this? And I'm grateful to say it's been a little over 9 years since I placed my last bet. Thank you so much for having us here today.
What a story. What a story. What a story. Thank you so much, Tara. Thank you, Christina, for sharing. Susan, again, for your leadership and your knowledge. Dr. B, what do you think? You know, I'm hearing these stories and I'm feeling the pain and also the relief, and I think a sense of joy that these sisters exhibit for having overcome. Yeah, and I don't sense that the notion of overcoming is a final. I sense that these are two individuals, two human beings who are conscious of the struggle that is occurring moment by moment, now and forever. That's how I'm looking at it, but maybe I'm wrong. Dr. D, what do you think? Well, before I ask you that, you know, before we went on the show, I talked to Susan about, she asked me, do I have any connections with problem gambling? And I said no at first, but I thought about it and mentioned to her that our newspaper, Inside News, is a advertiser for the Minnesota State Lottery. So yes, there's that connection. And I can tell you that my intention and desire to generate revenue from that process was both important and fruitful for me as a business owner. And the principles were not only for my business, but the principle of how our community, Black businesses and Black people, benefit from structures, systems, processes in government that sometimes have disadvantaged us. And I was trying to make an equation between that problem, you know, that and problem gambling. So as I'm promoting the lottery in my newspaper, am I promoting the potential for problem gambling, or is there a proper way? Well, you and I are both also involved in a contract, principally McFarland Media, to help create awareness about problem gambling. And this is the first step in that direction, one of a series of special forums we'll do, bringing experts and testimony like this to our community, and out of which we'll generate some content in social media and in the newspaper. But what is the, from our point of view, from our African-American experience, or simply from our American experience, Dr. B, how do we ingest this information and make sense of it? And I'm handing the talking stick back to you, Dr. B.
Thank you. As I was listening to the testimonials, I thought about how similar it is across culture when you still fight an addiction that has no concern about your race, gender, ethnicity, or social economic status. It's designed to take money from you. It's designed to make sure the house wins. And I think about how many of the clients that I see and in our community, gambling is not just an incident. It is a reflection of what many of us feel every day. We gamble when we find a job where we don't know if we're going to be safe or not. We gamble when we engage with systems like schools and jails and hospitals. And as I heard the familiar language that I have been hearing in sessions, spoken by these wonderful, powerful, recovering, resilient, beautiful sisters on this panel, I realized that we as Black people have a different path to recovery. And the path to recovery for us, though similar, is that do we deserve to recover? Do we have a right to recover? Is it our plot on earth? Is that our plight on earth to always be digging out and always be under duress, always feeling like we're on the losing end? And when you hear liberating language like I've just heard, no matter how you got to that place in gambling, no matter what you've lost, the idea that people can begin a liberation beyond their identity as gamblers, but those who say, I used to be, and I used to do. And I always say to people, every breath is a chance to start over. That's the way the Creator says, each breath, one breath away I was, this breath I am, and in the future, I can be a different person or make a different choice. So what I think is so powerful about these testimonies is that these sisters in this space broke a whole bunch of stereotypes about what gambling is supposed to be. And they've broken a whole lot of stereotypes about how healing is supposed to come about. It's an act of defiance to choose to heal. And that's what touched me so much about their testimonies. It was an act of defiance. It was like hell to the no, I'm not going to keep doing it. And I just love that we can hear that and bear witness to it in real human beings, just like us. We're more alike than different. And I always say we're more alike than different. All of us are filled mostly with water. We just come in different containers. But our lived experience on this path takes us to a common end place, which is also a beginning. The end place that says, hell to the no, I'm not going to keep doing it. Somewhere that demarcation, y'all drew the line in the sand. And the enemy was yourself. And the other social structures designed to keep you a prisoner. Mm-mm. But all I can say, these sisters broke loose. They busted out of jail. And what I'm seeing is that that's the message that resonates with our community.
Thank you, Dr. B.
That's what I meant to say.
Sometimes we get bandwidth issues. So a person might warble a little bit or go out to the rest of us. If somebody is not there, just keep it going. Keep the conversation going. Don't worry about it. So let me go back to Susan then. Susan, again, to contextualize this and to put these testimonies and this analysis from Dr. B in context, general questions, how prevalent is gambling addiction in Minnesota? And, you know, in Minnesota, it's illegal to bet on sports. So how do Minnesotans bet on sports? How does it happen? And then what should we be learning or knowing about betting on unregulated apps? What does social access, social media access do? And I think you mentioned it earlier, 9 signs, but you might review again some of the warning signs for gambling addiction. So, but again, context, what about the prevalence of gambling addiction in Minnesota?
So the last prevalence study that was done in Minnesota, 250,000 Minnesotans land on the spectrum. So meaning they meet 1 to 9 of the criteria so that they're thinking quite a bit about their gambling. They're making more bets and spending more money than they probably can afford to lose. They're trying to win back their losses. They're lying. Their relationships are being broken. Those are all the various signs. And, you know, you were talking about the economics of having the lottery advertise in your newspaper. And mm-hmm. and the lottery serves on our board, and I consider us to have a good partnership with the lottery. In terms of looking at the harms that gambling has on a specific portion of the population, not everyone is negatively impacted, but for those that are, as a state-sanctioned activity, we as a people have to support those that find themselves harmed by this activity. So that's why it's really important to have funding for prevention and research and treatment. And we don't, as a nation, and certainly as a state, are not doing all that we can. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about some connections to mental health and substance use disorder. This addiction is highly comorbid with those other addictions and mental health issues. And yet, as a state and as a nation, really, we're not screening people. We're not assessing. We're not asking the questions. And ways in which we can really minimize harm is to have conversations from a very early age. Because if there's addiction within a family, if there's mental health issues, you know, there are connections. And I think Tara was able to touch upon that with her own story. And, you know, we have to, when we don't acknowledge something, if we keep it in the dark, it serves no one. And so conversations early on. And, you know, within all communities, we have, you know, young athletes who have visions of wanting to be successful, you know, to hit the pros. And but if they're gambling and they're taking those risks, they risk their economic future. Mm-hmm. So these are kinds of conversations that we should be having in every community. There are specific cultural differences, but ultimately we're all dealing, you know, we're all people. addiction hits us. It doesn't discriminate, but we just have to be aware of how it affects each of us culturally and how we respond to that.
So is there data on the impact of problem gambling that is culturally indexed at all or not?
There's a little bit, not enough. Quite frankly, they're just, you know, there's no federal money set aside for mm-hmm. problem gambling. Each state is responsible for funding whatever research. It's very minimal. The best, actually, the best research we have in this state is the Minnesota Student Survey, which asks fifth graders, eighth, ninth, and 11th graders what their habits and practices are with a number of things. And there's a few questions on gambling. So we know that 7,100 high school students in Minnesota are landing on the problem gambling spectrum. That's totally unacceptable. I mean, we should be horrified by that number, and we're not. We have no prevention in the schools. And to me, that's just reprehensible. So it's dependent on community leaders to understand the connections of all of this and how we can, you know, be truthful about it and not shameful when somebody comes across a gambling problem.
Let me hit Greg, because I want to say this, Susan. I think part of the problem with educating is if people see that there's something wrong with it in the first place. See, so not many people in our culture, they don't see that there's anything possibly or potentially wrong with gambling until it's one of them or somebody they know directly. And I think that one of the biggest problems is that when it comes to the African-American population, a lot of our gambling is very, very associated with symptoms of anxiety and depression and grief and loss. And the link to the gambling is that it kind of does that stimulation in the brain, the pleasure center. For that little bit of time, you just forget. You forget about how terrible it is that you can't pay your rent. You came out to get extra money so you could pay your rent. Now you don't have enough to pay your rent at all or even part of it. And so in our culture, one of the problems is we feel like we can't go to mental health providers because that tears us away from our belief in God. And if you believe in God, your faith will tell you, you have enough faith, you shouldn't be depressed. Or if you have faith in God, you would need to go talk to a counselor. Or if you have faith in God, he would deliver you from all these gambling demons without you doing any work. So all of these multiple cumulative, culturally laden excuse barriers for our community to do the help seeking. And I know I read some research that talked about of all the populations, we tend to hook our gambling. It tends to be more associated with already pre-morbid, pre-existing mental health disorders. And so we're just finding something else to hang with it that makes it even more complex to deal with that depression or that loss of that historical or present day trauma. And so I think I can't see treating gambling without treating the hurt that pre-existed it.
Absolutely. I think if we're not being honest with ourselves and how comprehensive this addiction is with other things, what its relationship is, then we're not addressing the problems at all, which is why we're constantly asking, you know, behavioral health people to screen, just ask some questions. Because if somebody says, yeah, I tend to spend a lot of my time at the casino, or I'm spending time on my phone doing gambling. Okay, so let's investigate that. Why? You know, why are you spending more time? What's behind that? But if we're not asking those questions, we'll never know.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. It's Friday. It's The Healing Circle. My colleague and co-host, Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya, Executive Director of the African American Child Wellness Institute, is here with me, along with three excellent guests, Susan Sheridan Tucker, who's with the Minnesota Alliance of Problem Gambling, and two sisters who just shared deeply personal stories about the impact of gambling in their personal lives. Christina Cook is here, and also Tara Carbett is here. And I have a question. It's in our notes for Christina and Tara. Flow with this any way you want to, but can you share examples of how gambling ripples beyond the individual? How does it impact your family, your workplace, your community? And what do people often overlook when they talk about and think about who's being impacted by problem gambling? And finally, build into that, how do you balance respecting somebody's independence, their person, no space, while still raising red flags? How do you do that in a way that doesn't condemn, that facilitates awareness, healing, and solution-making that the individual that's impacted can own and not feel is being imposed upon him or her? Christina, Tara, either one of you guys.
I'll jump in and kind of speak to the first part of it, and maybe Tara can add on. She's always quick with these questions. So I think, the ripple impact is when you're struggling with anything, whether it's gambling or any type of mental health struggle, it really does impact everything around you. It impacts your relationships, impacts the way you view yourself. It impacts how you show up at work. It impacts so many different ways. And I know they say gambling, when you're a person struggling with gambling, it ripples out and can impact, is it 8 to 10 people, around you? And I remember when I was going through recovery, and a lot of my behaviors impacted I have a twin sister who does not have an issue with gambling. But a lot of the financial impacts were on her because, like, I would borrow money and I wouldn't pay it back, or I would do all of these things to her because, you know, she loved me and she didn't know what I was going through either. She just knew she wanted to help me. And as I was going through therapy later and kind of addressing the ripple impact, the impacts of my addiction around me, it was mentioned that, well, you need to make amends to your brother-in-law. And I was like, my brother-in-law, I just couldn't see that connection, right? But then my therapist just plainly looked at me and said, you hurt your sister and he deeply loves your sister. He deeply, you know, loves you. You hurt him. And I think it was a combination of my therapist and my mom pointing this out. And it just like devastated me. It devastated me that I had to bring somebody else into the harm that I created. And it was somebody I wasn't even considering. So, you know, just to address that question in my own personal experience, yeah, it really, even beyond who you think you've harmed, it goes further, and maybe not in the same way, but in a way. And to know that and to carry that sometimes was the hardest part of my recovery, was who all was impacted. My employer, because I didn't show up ready to work. I was struggling, or, you know, those types of things. And to really kind of think about that ripple effect. But what really helped me is I knew that working my recovery was going to have the same ripple effect. It was going to start healing and bringing a lot of things back into my life and being able to rebuild those relationships and bring them to a healthier place. And I knew that I had to do that through action, that my words weren't going to be as meaningful as me just showing up and doing that really hard work of recovery, that really hard work of amends. And just, you know, the ripple effects of that, I was really, really just surprised by how willing everybody was to work with me and to, you know, accept my apologies and to allow me to work on the harm. So that's kind of where I'm at with that, with my lived experience. I hope that answered at least part of the question, and I'm going to give the talking stick to Tara.
Before we go to Tara, take a minute to describe the Broke Girl Society.
Yes, the Broke Girl Society is very much a part of my own recovery. It stemmed from my recovery. And I think this is a good question to kind of talk about, you know, what we see in recovery spaces and how we navigate recovery. So for me, I was in a lot of spaces that had a real male lens, a real male-focused space. And though it was really, really helpful for me, I was still looking for women who are experiencing the same challenges as me in recovery. And so I created the community, the Broke Girl Society. It's a podcast, but we have a community of 3,200 women who have been impacted by gambling, where we get to support each other and show up for each other. Tara is co-admin with me on the Broke Girl Society. And it's a space where women can come in and just share about more things than just necessarily the gambling harm, but they can talk about mom guilt, navigating relationships in recovery, and just really kind of talk about the aspects of recovery that sometimes spaces where you're commingled with men, it's just not, there's not a lot of opportunity to do that, to talk about hormones, especially hormones in recovery, and how hormones can impact how we navigate some challenges. And I think that those are conversations that are really, really important. And so we do that work through the Broke Girl Society podcast and through the community. And it's just part of that rippling effect of my own recovery of how can I do this in a way that welcomes more people in.
Awesome. Tara, I'm going to pass the talking stick over to you again now.
Gladly take it. Christina did an excellent job of talking about how gambling issues have that ripple effect beyond just the individual. I think I'll just kind of piggyback and add the things that I think we could expand on. And one for me personally that I recognize, I was completely disengaged from community. I wasn't giving of service in the same way that I do today. I was absorbed in my own turmoil and grief. And, you know, Christina and I both, and many other people who have found recovery and gone on to impact their own lives, have then gone on to impact the lives of others in a very positive ripple effect-y kind of way. But when we think about the disengagement from community and the lack of participation, going to a town hall, participating in a fundraiser, volunteering, all of that lack of participation is harmful to the entire community that we are all part of. And I think that's not unique to gambling addiction. I think addiction broadly, for people who are trapped in that cycle, are not living into their fullest potential and what, you know, spirit, I'll gladly use that word, may have been calling them to do. The voices of a calling to participate in being your best self and bring your purpose and your passion into the world as you were divinely created to do, in my opinion, that's all muted when you're living in addiction. And so, as Christina pointed out, you know, family, friends, coworkers, and even institutional harm, many of us gambling, exceeded our debts, had bad debts, experienced mortgages, and there's economic impact. Right. And some people unfortunately have justice involved cases where they've stolen millions from employers. And so their coworkers are even more affected if that financial harm creates a closure of an organization as a result of their embezzlement or theft. So those are some things that I didn't hear mentioned. I think in terms of people overlooking who's impacted, I'll speak from a place of what I see in recovery rooms where I attend, you know, in contrast to what I see on the casino floor, if that's okay. I walk around the casino when I was gambling, and there wasn't a group that wasn't represented, not a single one. We were all there. When I walked into rooms of recovery, my experience, thankfully for me, was a little bit different than Christina's, but it was 50-50 women and men for me. I think hers was more like 90-10 men to women, and it was 99.9% white. That's not what the makeup of the casinos look like. That is not what the makeup of the bingo halls look like. That is absolutely not the street game of dice, what that looks like. And I have gambled in all of those ways. And so I think the overlooking, it's something I bring up in our local rooms of recovery and yet ponder, you know, why is this space a place where others are not finding recovery? And speaking very directly, they're not entering the rooms. And so as Christina has modeled, creating a place where women can gather, important. And I think the same is true for starting recovery rooms that are uniquely designed to serve the needs of specific communities.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you, Dr. B. Thank you, Susan Sheridan Tucker. Thank you, Christina Cook. And thank you, Tara Carbert. I'm Al McFarland. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
In the town of Hastings, Minnesota, lived a kid with big dreams, Dwayne Peterson. Born at the tail end of the Great Depression, Dwayne knew he was set apart for something special. So he moved to California, pursuing a career as an entertainer. It was the 1960s. The lyrics of Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles became the voice for youth culture, and many were defying traditional values, dropping out and dropping acid. But Dwayne thought that Jesus was missing in their pursuit for peace and love.
You need to be born again so that you can worship him. He is a loving God, a caring God, a tender God.
He soon launched the Hollywood Free Paper, a countercultural response. The newspaper reached over millions and became a vehicle for a ministry outreach called The Living Room, run by hippies for hippies. Suddenly, revival hit like wildfire, and Dwayne became the founder of one of the largest religious movements in America, Over 8,000 people were baptized on the shores of Corona Del Mar, all professing to be born again.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis.